I think we'll go ahead and get started. First, I'd like to thank you all for coming out in this awful heat, and I hope that you didn't have too far to walk in it to get here. My name is Ginny Bouvier. I'm a senior program officer in the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program here at the Institute, and I'd like to welcome you here for Senior Fellow Avisagi Schwartz's project report on Children of Chronic War, Vulnerability, Resistance, and Prospects for Peace in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. In today's talk, Dr. Sagi Schwartz will draw insights and present findings from the field of human development regarding the impact of chronic warfare on current and future generations, and will discuss the implications of his research for the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. While a fair amount of public attention has recently been focused on the issue of child soldiers, and there are some case studies for particular conflicts, there's little meta-analysis that draws together the literature on the psychological implications of the impact of chronic violence on children. Dr. Sagi Schwartz helps fill this gap by analyzing the studies that have been done, drawing broad conclusions about the effects of prolonged trauma on children in regions of political violence, with an eye toward understanding what makes children, and subsequently emerging adults, more or less resilient in the face of conflict, and what these implications of these findings might be for generational attitudes toward the management of violent political conflicts and reconciliation. This project complements earlier USIP work by former senior fellows Marie Smith on child soldiers in South Africa, Palestine, and Northern Ireland, Rosalind Shaw on reconciliation and child soldiers in Sierra Leone, and Betty Bagombi's ongoing work on child soldiers in Uganda. The Middle East crisis today cries out for innovative approaches and fresh ideas, and Dr. Sagi Schwartz breaks new ground in this regard. His fellowship project has clear implications for enhancing the prospects of peace in the Middle East and in other areas of long-standing conflict. By analyzing the impact of conflict on youth, Dr. Sagi has begun to identify key analytical questions and appropriate interventions from both a policy perspective and a psychological perspective. His findings are sure to provide donors as well with guidance for more effective interventions. Likewise, his work is enhancing the nexus between the scientific community and conflict resolution specialists. His human development approach builds bridges between the fields of social psychology and other academic fields, and with them and policymakers and practitioners. His work underscores the need to design interventions and policies that will diminish the impact of what has been called the social toxicity of chronic war conditions. Sagi Schwartz's work also contributes to ongoing work at USIP on trauma and post-conflict social reconstruction and reconciliation. Dr. Sagi Schwartz brings to the Institute a skill set and background that is uniquely suited to this task. He's a professor of psychology and social work at the University of Haifa in Israel, where he's also served as the dean of the graduate school and since 1992 as the director of the Center for the Study of Child Development. He's held visiting positions at the University of Utah, the University of Maryland at College Park, the U.S. National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, Regensburg University in Germany as an Alexander von Humboldt Scholar, and Leiden University in the Netherlands as the holder of the Mary Main Chair on Attachment Across the Lifespan. Dr. Sagi Schwartz holds a master's in social work, a master's in psychology, and a PhD in development psychology and social work from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. A few additional items before I turn over the podium to Dr. Sagi. First, I'd like to thank, if I can find him, Ethan Goldberg, sitting in the corner, who's been serving as Dr. Sagi Schwartz's RA and holds an MA in political science from George Mason University. He was largely responsible for organizing this gathering today, and I thank him for that. Second, for the media in the room, I offer our usual disclaimer that the speaker's views do not necessarily represent the positions of the U.S. Institute of Peace, as we do not take policy positions. And third, this event is being recorded live and will be available later from the USIP website. I'd ask that you kindly turn off your cell phones at this time and any other electronic devices you might have, because in addition to disrupting the event, they also will interfere with the recording of the event. And now, without further ado, I turn it over to Dr. Sagi Schwartz.
Thank you, Ginny, for this lengthy introduction and kind and warm words. I would like to thank the people who came in this area one day. Special thanks to Shiri, who is not here, and to Joan, Shira, and Erin of the JR Fellowship Program for providing really wonderful support at all possible levels in the past 10 months. Jeannie, my program officer, has been very conducive to the entire process, and I thank you again, Jeannie, so much. And last but not least, Eitan, again. Jeannie mentioned him. He has been very helpful to me with the content and technical issues and anything which has to do with a project like that. Before I start, I must say something, that we have a very difficult current situation where I come from, and specifically from Haifa. I live in Haifa, my family is in Haifa, and I guess no one really knows how it's going to develop, including the experts, I'm afraid. It's still, you know, very problematic. But I believe that once the situation will get stabilized, and hopefully it will get sooner than later, that what we do in the SAP, what I do, is important, because we deal, you know, actually with the deeper roots of many, many conflicts, and that's what I'm going to do today, to try to share with you some of my ideas. This is a brief outline, and I'm going to deal with two basic elements. One, I'm going to provide review of traumatic stress in war zones, which is one line of work and research, and then I'm going to also briefly talk about what is known in the field as social psychological foundations of intractable conflicts. And you will see we talk here about things which come from different thinking. I will try to integrate the two together as we move on, and then to talk about readiness to resolve conflicts and to reconcile by providing an ecological developmental transactional model. And if time permits, I will touch upon some recommended actions. Because I'm dealing with different issues here, my presentation might be kind of bumpy. You know, you might not see, you know, sometimes, you know, the coherence of some elements. I'll try to be as coherent as possible, but still there is the written report which I did, which I hope is more coherent. And also during the Q&A session, we could, you know, set some things up. For those in the audience who don't know, I'm not an expert, a traditional expert in issues of conflict management, in the sense, you know, that most people would like to see. I'm not, you know, in the diplomacy area, not in government studies, not in international relationships, not in history of conflicts. I'm a psychologist, as Jeannie mentioned, trying to bring in some information which is related, I hope, to the topics. So, as I said already at the beginning, I'm afraid I don't have any news about the current situation. I'm not an expert in the field, and I doubt if, you know, those who are experts have, as I mentioned, you know, a solution to the situation. But I'll try to present my developmental perspective and see how it might become helpful in some situations. What I would like to do, because I'm using to some extent, and I don't have, you know, too much time, I'd like to give you a very speedy, maybe the most speedy overview of some concepts that I've done in my academic career, you know, just to address some concepts that are pertinent to my review and analysis. And again, I'll be very happy to deal with it in the Q&A session for those concepts that I went too fast, I didn't explain it well, etc., etc. Okay? So, some parts I will read, just because I organize it in, but very minimally, I'll try. But, you know, some of the elements, you know, when I wrote it, you know, I guess it will convey, you know, some structure, direction of some concepts. And I would say that specifically a human development approach helps us understand the development and emergence of states of minds and forms of behaviors of those children, adolescents, and subsequently emerging adults who are victims of chronic exposure to political violence and unending social toxicity, so that appropriate approaches, policies, and interventions can be established. To the best of my knowledge, such a developmental approach is typically not part of most political discussions and analysis of conflict management. Once adopted as a plausible framework, it will become evident that there is much more room for success, I hope, in conflict management and peace building. So, as I said, I would like to introduce you to some concepts which, you know, it probably makes sense to you. I'm not inventing, you know, the wheel here. I mean, people know it, you know, from day to day, you know, living. But it's very important to know, you know, that we know from developmental research that there is a wide range of variability between people. People differ, and individual differences prevail. We know it on the one hand, but when we come to a conflict situation, we tend to generalize, to make group generalizations, so which sometimes be very detrimental. So we have to keep in mind that huge individual differences in developmental and growth outcomes. Also, a very important concept is, or direction is, that different people may be differentially influenced by similar events and experiences. We call it differential susceptibility. Even now, what's going on in the area? So devastating. We could see already, you know, different people appraise it differently. It's true, when the crisis is very, very profound, there is a tendency to see group directions. But I believe that sooner than later, we'll start to see individual differences and differential susceptibility to the same situation. So these are two basic concepts. I'll get later on to some other concepts, hopefully, which are relevant to my analysis. I have a colleague in Zagreb, Croatia, Gordana Jagodic, and she published a paper in the International Journal of Psychology in the year 2000, and the title was, "Is War a Good or Bad Thing?" That was the title. Well, I guess everybody would agree that war is bad, very bad. But the point is not whether it's bad or not bad, but I guess we have to go to some deeper questions, and I would like to focus in two related questions. One, does one have to become severely damaged when exposed to intractable conflicts and violence? That's a big issue. Okay. Second one, which also would like to know, how one ends up with peacemaking orientation despite exposure to such intractable political violence, and if so, how? These are two important questions, and I would like, and they are in the heart of my analysis, in the report which is outside, as well as in the extended monograph that I'm preparing now. I would like to continue with two personal stories. These stories, one Palestinian and one Israeli, might become rather telling because they not only illustrate that individual differences exist between people, but even more excitedly, they suggest important intrapersonal changes over time within the same individual, with apparently major turning points in one's life, hence, I believe, with paramount implications for policy and practice. I would like to start with Mr. Doher Manasseh, and I wrote it, so I'll read it to you because it's more organized. This is Doher Manasseh. He's a Palestinian, and an important turning point in my personal orientation toward the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was the following event. Sometime in the fall of 1997, when I served as the dean of the graduate school at the University of Haifa, I received a phone call from Mr. Manasseh, at that time the governor of the Jenin region in the West Bank, which is about 45 minutes drive from Haifa in normal days without the nuisance of military checkpoints. When we first met, Mr. Manasra asked me if the University of Haifa would consider admitting Palestinian students from his region to various graduate programs. He told me that in some clear days, he can see from Jenin the Eshkol Tower, it's a 30-floor tower, situated on Mount Carmel. It did not make sense to him that upon graduation from undergraduate programs, young Palestinian students would go primarily to Europe to obtain graduate education. To make a long story short, we jointly architected a mechanism to make this plan a reality. Eventually, a number of Palestinian students began their graduate training in various departments at the university. Now, so that sounds very promising, very good, but let's see what's behind it. Certainly, a number of obvious lessons behind this story, but most importantly is the following, at least, I believe, as far as how human development approach may view it. Keep in mind that Manasseh was born and grew as a child in a village near Hebron, spent decades abroad as a PLO fighter and representative. He was an active member, a senior member, of the Western sector of the Fatah, which was known as one of the units responsible for planning terrorist attacks on Israel. He returned to the West Bank in 1996, conveying to me thereafter a clear intention for establishing open normalcy in relationships. In his most recent position as governor of Bethlehem, Manasseh said, "The basic problem in this struggle is that from the beginning, the two sides try to destroy each other. There is no trust. There is a continuing bloody struggle that prevents logical debate. And Palestinian extremism feeds on Israeli government attacks, and Israeli extremism feeds on violent Palestinian actions." This is as far as Manasseh. Now I would like to read a short paragraph about Ami Ayalon, who is a Knesset member, Knesset parliament member in Israel. Knesset member Ayalon grew as a child in a different context, in an affluent kibbutz, and in his military service reached the top rank of Admiral of the Navy, Israeli Navy. Immediately after he retired as Admiral of the Navy, Mr. Ayalon was appointed by the Prime Minister as head of the Shin Bet, which is an Israeli General Security Service. Since his retirement from the military intelligence and security community, Mr. Ayalon has become publicly known for his endorsement of open and constructive dialogue with the Palestinians. It is Ayalon who called loudly for negotiated withdrawal of both Israeli settlements and military forces from Palestinian territories. Ayalon co-founded the People's Voice Initiative with Dr. Sarin Nusseibeh, president of the Palestinian Al-Quds University, with more than 400,000 Israelis and Palestinians publicly expressing support of the initiative. When Ayalon has recently become a member of the Knesset, he immediately expressed the opinion that Israel must find ways to dialogue with the Hamas rather than reject such a possibility. When asked to address the Hamas issue, Ayalon said, "Should we speak to the Hamas? They have blood on their hands. I have more blood on my hands. I killed more terrorists than they killed Israelis. And I say I have the right to lead any peace process. We should talk to everyone who accepts a two-state solution, and Israel is a Jewish state," he said. So as we move on, just keep in mind, you know, these stories. And I think there are many stories like that, and we could, you know, elaborate it more later. Now I would like to go to my field and to talk about the first issue of trauma, effects of trauma, and to look at people's mental health infrastructure. And actually I reviewed, as Jeannie mentioned, many studies, a lot of research. I've done myself some research, trying to integrate published as well as some unpublished studies. And actually I'm trying to look at the effects of trauma and experience with wars. And I use a notion presented by Garbarino, who talks about two forms of adaptation to danger. Actually, we adapt to danger. That's, you know, a biological, psychological tendency to adapt to dangers. And he talks about short term. And what we find here single events, acute danger, not chronic. And the typical reaction is fear and anxiety. We hear now in Israel, in Lebanon, you know, many people reacting quite, you know, extremely, which is very expected, you know, when you have acute, you know, attacks of the kind that unfortunately we see. So this is a natural reaction, and he calls it situational adjustment. We adjust to the situation. This is normative. This is expected. So even if we see very difficult, you know, symptoms, this is fine. We should take care of it. We should anticipate it. But we should, you know, look more, you know, closely at what might be the case, before, just to make a note that, you know, these effects might be transient and not necessarily enduring. Also, and I could, you know, quickly go through the responses of these elements, and most of the responses are self-directed at the intrinsic level: nightmares, sleep disturbances, fearfulness, clinginess to parents or caregivers, loss of concentration, distractibility, difficulty in problem solving, nervousness, anxiety, intrusive thoughts, depression, fatigue, social withdrawal, feelings of not belonging, and it could end up also with some basic trust problems. But basically, all these issues could disappear, not necessarily long term. He talks, Garbarino, also about long term. Outcomes may become enduring. And let's see what might be some characteristics. When we have chronic exposure, and definitely when we talk about Israel and the Palestinian Authority, we talk about 58 years of intractable conflict since if we start counting from the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948. So chronic exposure, we have loss of resources, fatigue, cascading effect. We should realize that we have no indefinite quantities of positive adaptational resources. And we may develop lack of trust about the self and others. More specifically, self might be perceived as unworthy when you are exposed for so long, you know, to traumas. And also lack of trust, and this is very worrying, in institutions which are seen as unreliable, threatening, and unsafe. Some symptoms are more toward others rather than, you know, inside. I call it extrinsic level. And what we might see is crystallization of violent personality style. And what we mean by that is, you know, some people may no longer activate risk feelings. Usually it's a tendency to be careful, but you no longer express risk feelings. Also, there might be what we call fixation at the vendetta stage of moral development. That is, you know, thinking very low level about moral implications of what we do. Desensitization to danger, simply not sensitive any longer to danger. Reckless, numb, pathologically brave attitudes. He calls it brave, you know, quote unquote, because the meaning is what the meaning of this, you know, being brave, you know, attitude and behaviors. And then violence also may become a tool for survival. And revenge seeking, especially when there is loss of hope and expectation for short life. I mean, this is something that we have to keep in mind because it may characterize societies like societies, you know, in our region. Now I would like to turn into some empirical studies, and this is going to be very quick, worldwide. And I don't have time to get into all the details, but I have here findings which come from Bosnia, Croatia, Cambodia, Kosovo, the Kurdish region in Iraq, Kuwait, Lebanon, Northern Ireland, Rwanda, Sri Lanka, South Africa, South America, and maybe there are some other countries that I didn't mention here. And major findings worldwide, actually, we should look. One aspect is the perception about parental care. And what we find is that some parents are no longer able to see themselves as a haven of safety, as protective, as caring and loving. This is a major problem for many, many parents. But when we look more carefully at parent and child outcomes, I would like to notice that the degrees of stress are varying. It's not that everybody responds the same. That's the nature of the research. That's what we find, varying degrees. And we might find also varying degrees of what we call post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, PTSD, psychological problems, and behavioral problems. So if we look more carefully, there are adverse effects of political violence, are certainly evidence, but we should look more carefully at that. And to see the extent, depth, and duration, which may vary on different factors. And there are the nature of the traumatic events, whether acute or chronic, direct or indirect exposure, and the severity of the trauma. Also, we should look at whether or not there are risk and protective factors present or absent in the environment. And when I talk about protective factors, I talk about family cohesion and functioning parents versus family chaos and malfunctioning parents, that at the family level, and at the community level, availability of supportive community and social networks versus diminishing social networks and distracted community infrastructure such as, you know, loss of housing and uprooting. Also, as I mentioned, we have to make a clear distinction between short-term versus long-term effects, and then to ask the questions, are there enduring effects of exposure to political violence? What I can tell you by summarizing very briefly, and in the extended report I'm going to refer to all these studies, that we find negative effects, but they tend to decline and disappear, even in war zones that induced extremely high level of violence and hostility. So here we have amazing phenomenon of resiliency. And some people say, so what? Why you're so worried about wars? People will make it. Yeah, well, I'm worried because it's pretty, you know, very detrimental, it's very destructive. But yeah, we have more strength and, you know, stamina to deal with it, even in the context I'm going to get to it in our area, because so far I just reviewed work in other countries. In some of the countries, we know that there was a very bloody struggle, you know, in the countries that I mentioned. Also, a most consistent finding is that wide spectrum, and again, repeat, individual differences with enormous resiliency in many children, maybe not all children, but many children, adolescents and emerging adults. This is something that we have to keep in mind. Now I would like to turn into Israel, because, you know, time is running so fast, and again, here, you know, in a few slides, I'm going to summarize work that has been done in various wars in intifada attacks, and unfortunately, there are many, 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 you know, these events since 1948. Here we have, just to remind us, this is the year 2002, it's a very bad situation, Al-Aqsa Intifada, and because I'm from Haifa, just to show you, you know, what it means to live in such a context, you know, I live in Haifa, and this restaurant that was, you know, terrorized in March 31st, 2002, Matza restaurant, is a joint restaurant, is a restaurant owned by Arab, Christian Arabs, and it's a very popular one, and I visited there one of the very rare days with my daughter and grandchild for lunch. I don't go with my daughter and grandson, you know, during a business day to lunch. 2 days before, I just was there, just to give you an idea what it means, you know, for us. And second one, again in Haifa, again, it's very difficult to explain. Bus number 37 is a symbol in Haifa. It's a very high SES area, and we don't have these yellow buses, as unfortunately as, you know, you guys have, you know, in the USA. So people use public transportation. Bus 37 is a very popular one, and my three daughters used to take, you know, this bus, you know, regularly to their back, you know, from home to schools and back. And actually, my daughter lives very near, you know, one of these buildings here. So it's very real. It's not something remote. I'm not talking about something, you know, far from. Okay. So, let's take a look at the psychological level. It's going to be very similar, actually. We see varying degrees of stress, PTSD symptoms, psychological problems, and behavioral problems. When we analyze it very carefully, 5 decades of intractable conflict, 1948, we find that some children react in times of crisis with varying degrees of normative distress. I mentioned it's normative distress. Little severe PTSD symptoms, so psychological or behavioral problems. I know that I may antagonize some of my colleagues because, especially in these times, you know, many psychologists, you know, it's their arena, you know, intervening, and definitely it's necessary. But we have to put it in some proportions. And something, you know, we have some debates about some interventions in real time. I don't have time to get into it. But in a nutshell, I think, based on what I understand and reviewed, is that there is little severe PTSD symptoms or psychological behavior problems, and most often, again, they are transient and evaporable over time, which is, you know, promising, at least, you know, as far as exposure to the world. Okay? What are the strongest accounts for these phenomenal capacities? Well, one is solid family infrastructure, and the second is solid community infrastructure. And I must say, you know, fortunately, and this is a paradox in Israel, you know, with all these complexities, and I'm focusing now in Israel, the Palestinian context might sound a bit different. We have good, you know, we have excellent infrastructure. So we criticize it as Israelis. We feel it should be better. But basically, the infrastructures are community levels at all domains, function very well, and probably it serves a very important buffer, even, you know, in these very difficult days. And again, the family structure, which, when it's solid, also provides a very important infrastructure. And again, individual differences. Some people are simply resilient. That's the nature of, you know, of their life. You know, they are resilient, and even without, you know, family support, even without community elements, they have it. You know, it's there. Luckily, and that's the nature of, you know, survival. Now I would like to turn to the Palestinian Authority. This might be a bit, you know, more complicated, even though you will see at the end of the road that, you know, we have some promising data as well. Most of my review is based on work done by the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, and I would like just to commend what they do, because, you know, they conduct really cutting-edge research in under very different types of, you know, adversities, and they share the information. Some is not published, so I said, you know, that, you know, we have also access to unpublished work, but I think that in general it's quite, you know, high quality work, and they deal with Palestinian children in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, refugee camps, villages, and cities. Now, we have one line of research comes from the first intifada, which was described by some people as intifada of hope. And again, when we look at this, in this context, we see varying degrees of stress, PTSD symptoms, psychological problems, etc., etc. So it varies. It's not the same. Now, let's talk a little bit about chronic exposure to war and danger in this context. And I would like to introduce the... go back to Garbarino, who talked about toxic environments. And here we see, this is, you know, we see it, you know, all the time, kids and guns, the Palestinian side, but, you know, to make it equal, you will see I have later on also a slide with Israeli kids carrying, you know, in different contexts I'm going to show it, carrying, you know, kids carrying guns. This is very toxic, you know, for children to carry guns. It's really the worst case scenario of toxicity. And actually, Garbarino talked about destruction of daily infrastructure. It is essential for ensuring positive moral interpretation. And when all the infrastructure is destructed, very difficult to expect people to develop, you know, high levels of moral interpretations. And I was trying to refer to it when I talked about the extrinsic outcomes before, when I talked about Garbarino. Okay, and then, you know, no surprise, according to the reports of Garbarino, they developed bravery in combating Israeli soldiers and reckless disregard for their safety. They don't care, you know, short life anyway, who cares, I can simply, you know, do very crazy. And we can see the pictures, you know, a child, you know, throwing stones, you know, on, you know, military, you know, vehicle of the Israeli army. I mean, he doesn't care. Also, it becomes very difficult to function as parents and to provide a secure base and a haven of safety to ensure normal growth. And yet, what we get from most of the research is that Palestinian parents are found to do their utmost to produce a secure environment for their children. And some of the major protective factors, as described by Puna Maki, she is a Finnish psychologist, cooperative, doing a lot of work in the Gaza area in the West Bank. She talks about, again, things that we know, that good parenting moderate the negative impact of traumatic experiences. And she is using very, you know, fine measurements that we use, you know, in, you know, most advanced in the area of the reverse psychology to index parenting, and she found that some parents can do it quite well. They moderate the negative impact, even, you know, under the worst case scenarios. And also, when they have what we call mental flexibility, when the parent has, you know, flexibility, plasticity, it serves as a resiliency factor. Also, the positive side, what they found that children, and I know, I present it from a scientific point of view, and I know that, you know, some Israelis don't like, you know, these kind of observations because, you know, it immediately has, you know, or might turn into a political connotation. But children have become maybe too early in their life to be active, not necessarily in violence, but to be active, social activists, political activists. And what they found is that self-esteem increased for these kids because of the Oslo Accord. So these kids, you know, feel like, you know, when there is something promising, I was active, now my self-esteem is better. This is very promising, you know, when we put it in a psychological context. Also, Barbier, who studies a lot in the Gaza Strip, he's focusing primarily on adolescence. And he talks a lot about the perceived meaning of political activism in the mind of the activist, and he thinks that it provides information showing that it has implications for positive identity and personal growth. And he also notes that severe psychological symptoms dissipate with decline in acute political violence and danger, and with replacement by emerging peaceful conditions. So this, you know, even, you know, these kids, these adolescents who show negative symptoms, once they have hope, there is a shift in their psychological expressions to the positive direction. ACTSA, Now, the Al-Aqsa Intifada has been known as Intifada of Despair, and again, the studies are in the same areas, and negative psychological side, it's the same. I'm not going to repeat it, okay, just to save time. I mean, one would expect the same symptoms. But here I would like to refer, because of toxicity, especially within the context of the Al-Aqsa University, to a model known as the staircase to terrorism. And I would like to thank Professor Moghaddam, actually, who wrote, you know, and developed this model. And I think it's a seminal publication in a flagship journal of the American Psychological Association in the year 2005, American Psychologist. I would like briefly, and you could correct me later if I don't represent you properly. And, you know, a lot can be said here. But first of all, just a summary of what we don't find, you know, we find, you know, little validity in the notion that try to explain terrorism on the assumption of high level of pathology among terrorists. And secondly, that, you know, it has to do with deprived background and little education. This is not the case. Okay? Dr. Moghaddam actually talks about a staircase to terrorism, many, many steps that I don't have time to describe, but actually the major element in this model that actually at the very ground level, which is still wide, before one would turn to consider terrorism, the perceived options are very bad, not optimistic, nothing to expect. So then they move into the next one, it's a narrowing staircase, might become very accessible. And yet, I would like to emphasize, and this is again promising because we have a tendency to generalize, only few people move up on this staircase. It's a minority. Now, I know, then it's a question which is beyond, you know, my mandate here. You know, it becomes, and there is discussions, you know, okay, minority. How do we deal with a minority? This is already a political, strategic, I don't know, I don't want to get into that. But psychologically, it's likely to happen, definitely. There are explanations for that, psychological explanations, but it's a minority. At the end of the day, it's a minority. We have to keep it in mind because we tend to make generalizations about certain populations. Okay? And we have some data coming from fieldwork in Northern Ireland, Lebanon, in some recent work about the Al-Aqsa Intifada, showing that those experiencing chronic danger, and this is really chronic danger, might become primary force in generating recruits for participation in terrorist violence. It has, I guess, substantial implications, you know, for policy and intervention. But again, not here. Just wonder if somebody would... It's a quiz. Would especially the Israelis who are here, you know, would know who is this little boy. You could read.
Ehud Barak.
Ehud Barak. Yeah, this is Ehud Barak. Okay, Ehud Barak, former Prime Minister of Israel, former Chief of Staff, Israel Defense Forces. 1998, when he was campaigning to become a Prime Minister, he said, quote, "If I was a young Palestinian, I might have also joined a terror organization." And this fellow, who said it from a strength perspective, you know, living in an affluent kibbutz, you know, had, you know, all the positions, chief of staff, you know, he said it, you know, I could take the role of those who, you know, who develop it, and I might also die, okay? So now we have some data which are very worrying, and, you know, we have to keep it in mind, you know, coming again from the Gaza group, 34% of boys, age of 12 to 14, say that the best thing to do in life is to die as a martyr, in the context, of course, of suicide bombing. Okay, so if Barak could say, as somebody who was, you know, campaigning for the high position of prime minister, I mean, when we have, you know, very chronic, you know, very toxic context, and if we adapt the model of Moghaddam of perceived options, there is no surprise that we see it more and more. I just skip this one because time is running out, and I would like to mention something about coping and resilience side of Palestinians. And actually, we have information, again, based on this research, showing that Al-Aqsa Intifada enhances in children feeling of pride and identity. It comes up, you know, in the research. Activity added to their self-confidence. Even here in the second Intifada, which is much more, you know, aggressive, violent, brutal. Also, we have some data coming, recent data coming about, again, it depends from what side. We call it, the Israelis call it security wall, the Palestinians call it separation wall, the wall, okay, the well-known wall. Some work, it's primarily qualitative with all the limitations, but we, you know, here we have quotations. A child says a wall of 8 meters might collapse, but you can never burn our hearts. And actually, Nadira Kevorkian suggests that actually the wall has become a new site of frustration and resistance. And also, she notices many, many elements of high flexibility in discovering our ways of achieving goals. So what do we do? How do we maneuver? So we see, you know, a great deal of, you know, being busy with how to deal, you know, with a new situation. Quota, who is Kuta, who is a senior researcher, director of research in the Gaza Center, actually provides findings which refute the claim that Palestinian parents push their children to war. And of course, one could, you know, say, you know, he's Palestinian, he might, you know, bias the data. It's problematic. I don't have time to get into that. But I think that to a large extent, you know, one could see the objectivity of some of these data, even though these people definitely are also, you know, political, you know, activists. And sometimes, you know, one should read carefully the data, and I read the data carefully, and I think that, you know, the findings really refute, you know, this direction. And also he shows, you know, feelings of expressed love and support, which are core emotions in most Palestinian parents. And he talks about unbelievable stamina and strength that science cannot explain. Well, I don't know what, you know, what science can or cannot explain. That's, you know, his phrasing. He said, you know, it goes against all odds. But it goes. That's the direction, you know. And the good news, along this line, the children are resilient. Many are able to cope effectively with the after effects of exposure to trauma. But we need to provide support of family and also community support. I guess I will skip this one. Just go to the bottom of the slide, showing that when we have protective factors, like family and community, we find fewer negative effects, definitely, and not all children experiencing or witnessing trauma will exhibit behavior problems. Again, very important to keep in mind. Now I would like to turn to a different line of work. It's it's about what Bartal, my colleague from Tel Aviv University, talks about social psychological foundations of intractable conflicts. In my outline, I talked about there was a second element. I'm going to be much more, you know, brief about it, but it's very relevant. And he talks about obstacles at the society level, beliefs, stereotypes, and attitudes. What he found is that actually in intractable conflicts, societies, in order to protect themselves psychologically, they have to develop a sense of justness of one's own goals. What I'm doing is the correct way. Security becomes a very major element. Patriotism, and it becomes very difficult when it becomes blind patriotism. I don't have time to develop what it means, you know, blind, but, you know, without checking, you know, what we are doing. Development of positive self-collective image. We are the better, we know what we are doing, we are the good guys. Self-collective victimization. We are the victims, of course. Each side developed this kind of direction. And delegitimizing of the enemy. And here again, I promised you that I'm going to show you. We find it also in the Israeli side, very early stage, you know, kids within this context, you know, using guns. So I was concentrating on toxic environment in the Palestinian context because, you know, it makes, you know, it's easier to explain it because of the destruction of the infrastructure. But this is certainly very toxic, and it's very difficult to deal with that when we have these societal obstacles. And in this very day, you know, now the Israeli society, for example, is very united around what is taking place. I don't have time to get into that. And it's exactly around these notions of obstacles at the society level. Now, how do we combine? That's my attempt, and I'll try to do it quickly because time is running. How we find the interface between two different vectors? One vector is a vector which I was trying to show in more lengths, that there is mental health and resiliency at the individual level, can we see it in both societies, and at the same time we have very strong social psychological obstacles at the society level. How these are conflicting vectors, how do we deal with them? So what I would like to do quickly is to tell you that, again, some concepts, I'll do it quickly, how people establish trustful and distrustful interpersonal relationships. This is something that I need, this, you know, a year in my graduate class, you know, to explain how it evolves, but I'll try to share with you quickly some important concepts that are relevant to my model. One is what we call the circle of trust. Some of us develop from early on in life circles of trust. We believe, we trust people. Some do not. They develop circles of limited trust. And there are developmental trajectories to that, which I don't have time to get into. The end result is that some people have balanced, secure state of mind as adults with regard to interpersonal relationships, and these people are more open to exploration into quest for alternatives. They are balanced. They don't judge the world in a black and white, you know, context. Another related concept is goal-corrected partnership. We are always in partnerships, and actually we may or may not develop an ability to appraise the partner's goals throughout the discourse while delaying our own goals and by negotiating compromises. That's what we would like to see in, you know, in a good development. And also a capacity and willingness to modify one's own goals in order to maintain cooperation in the relationship. And also ability for forgiveness. Again, we don't have time to talk about it, but at the end of the road, we would like, you know, in any conflict management, to think also about forgiveness and reconciliation. All of which may lead, if we have it, to constructiveness in conflictual contexts. And people vary. Again, there are individual differences. Some are along these lines, some are not. Now I'd like to turn to an ecological developmental transactional model of readiness to resolve conflicts and to reconcile. This is the last part of my presentation. I'll try to do it quickly. And actually, we I refer to individual development, and I think we should look at individual development via six intertwined operating systems. It's not my invention. It's based on the work of other people talking about system theory, but I try to adapt it and to revise it in the context of our discussion today. And the six systems are intra-individual system, microsystem, exosystem, macrosystem, geopolitical, geostrategic system, and the chronosystem. I'll try to quickly show that you know, these systems have a transaction and dynamic influence between when they transact with each other in the ecology, and it may have implications for different outcomes. Let's see. This is a model, and actually what I'm trying to do here, it's a model that deals with readiness to resolve conflicts and to reconcile, a developmental ecological model. We have the operating systems, the six systems which I mentioned, and actually the end result might be, after I will try to show the transactions, that some people may develop a balanced, flexible, open, and readiness to explore and to reconcile conflict situations, whereas some other will be one-sided, rigid, locked, unable to explore and to reconcile. And we should note that all these systems that I mentioned, I'm going to exemplify in a minute, the individual, micro, exo, etc., some elements in each system may have impeding factors, may be positive, may induce positive contribution, and it may be short-term, enduring, and permanent, and some might be impeding is going against the positive, okay, and facilitative factors contributing to positive development, and again, it might have short-term, enduring, and permanent influences. Now, when I talk about the intra-individual, let's see, quickly, we talk about basically, and I don't have time and I don't want to get into things which are beyond, you know, your expertise, but you know, we talk basically about built-in biological components, maturational processes, and developmental trajectories that may exert influence on the environment, and the environment then might feed back to the child and to the developing person. Many examples, just to make it very simple, you know, when we have good nutrition, you know, good development. When we have malnutrition, very bad development, to the extent that it may have effects on the brain. Now, in war situation, when we have malnutrition, you know, we might already at that time begin, you know, to create a situation where people may be malfunctionally developed, to the extent that even the brain might be, you know, impacted. The microsystem is the layer closest, in closest proximity and contact with the child. And actually we talk here about parents, family members, teachers, peers, others that are in direct interaction with the child. And actually within this context of interaction, we develop all these circles of security, or limited circles of security, and the ability to correct the partnerships, and the goals in the partnerships, via the interaction with these, you know, micro systems. So again, in war situations, when some of these systems might become chaotic, uncontrollable, they may become impeding in the system. And again, those parents who could do it, and as I was trying to show, many parents could do it, they serve as buffer against the risk factors. The exosystem, again, quickly, it's a system which is more distant layer, and individuals do not necessarily, children, adolescents do not necessarily have direct influence. It's just an example, is a father goes to work and good things happen in the work. If good things happen in his, you know, employment, it might, you know, affect positively the child. If bad things, you know, happen, you know, it's very easy, you know, it's very tempting, sometimes, you know, uncontrollable, you know, to transmit it, you know, via a closer layer of the microsystem. Okay? So this exosystem. The macrosystem is a very tricky one. It has to do, you know, with the societal obstacles that I was trying to mention. And definitely we talk about indirect effects, but it has, you know, it might have very powerful effects. If we talk, for example, Israelis' negative perceptions of Palestinians and vice versa, Palestinians have negative perceptions about Israelis, it might be transmitted via their interactions with trained parents, teachers, the media, political leaders, and the like. Violent acts against each other may then gain legitimacy and become serious impeding factors in the willingness to enter into an open and constructive dialogue with the other side. On the other hand, so this is impeding, on the other hand, when we consider the data reported by Shikaki from Ramallah, showing that the Palestinians' willingness to compromise is greater than it has been at any time since the start of the peace process and also since the Hamas victory, we can appraise this finding as a societal indicator that may play a facilitative role in making more people ready to negotiate with the other side. I don't have time, so I won't get into all kinds of NGOs that, you know, plays as a buffer at the macro level and all kinds of, and I would like to continue to the geopolitical level. And actually, what we have now, the Hezbollah, the war with the Hezbollah, Israel and the Hezbollah is a very striking example of a very powerful impeding factor, at least for the time being. For now, we couldn't move on. Not to do anything. It's a very powerful one. You talk to a typical Israeli, you know, who tell you, you know, and there are some polls, some information, you know, people are standing behind it, you know. But that's, I'm saying, for the time being. But it's a very, very, you know, powerful impeding factor in this, you know, equation. And we cannot, you know, overlook. At the same time, I would like to note, and I have data before this, you know, bloody war, you know, I was trying to look if there's some data in the notes. Well, people don't, luckily, you know, people don't collect, you know, data now, you know, more important things to do. But just recent data show, before, you know, the event, that 3/4 of Israelis said that withdrawals negotiated with Palestinian Authority are preferable to unilateral ones. And by the way, there are some data indicating, I guess I just saw yesterday, even within the context of the turmoil in Israel, that still most Israelis would prefer a negotiated withdrawal rather than a unilateral, amazingly, you know. And also what we find, this is a joint public opinion poll by Shamir, an Israeli and Shikaki Palestinian, showing that surprisingly, it's before the turmoil, okay? 62% think that Israel should talk to Hamas if it proves to be vital in promoting a settlement within the Palestinians. So there is a gap between, you know, what people think and between, you know, what politicians, you know, convey to us. But what politicians convey to us is an effect, and it's part of this equation. The last system is the chronos system. It's a virtual system. It's a system of time. People change, and systems may have differential influences along the time axis. And Manasseh and Ayalon are good examples. You know, Manasseh, active Fatah, you know, person, change. And we saw, you know, the quotations. The same Ami Ayalon, Shin Bet, you know, responsible, you know, for dealing, you know, with terrorist activities, wants to talk, you know, to these people. So this is an example of the chronos system, okay? So actually we have, to sum up, impeding factors, facilitating factors within each of these systems. It's very complex. Actually, there is a pendulum here, you know, that would end up in the end of the road, you know, in some people who are more balanced and open, and those who are more one-sided, and we could discuss it later and try to finish in a few minutes. Let's see. I guess time is really running out now, so I will not get into all the recommended, you know, actions, because, you know, but we could talk about it in the Q&A session, and it's also in my, you know, paper, which those who get it, I believe it's available outside, but I would like to say some final words, which have to do with some of my conclusions. It becomes evident, I believe, that my analysis about vulnerability, resilience, and prospect for peace in an intractable conflict favors largely bottom-up activities with reliance on the enormous variability among individuals. We don't appreciate, you know, what people have because of our tendency to generalize in black and white. Of course, an effective top-down diplomatic solution is more than essential at these difficult times. But for that to happen, we certainly need outstandingly creative and visionary leadership. Big crisis needs smart people, and this is a crucial test not only for Hamas, but for all the regional and international players, said my colleague Iyad El-Sarraj from Gaza. He's a prominent child psychiatrist. And to sum up, let's see the following experience of Dr. El-Sarraj. Following this course is a story of El-Sarraj, who described the situation at an Israeli checkpoint when crossing the border from Gaza and when approached by a young Israeli soldier. "Your friend says that you're a psychiatrist. Can I ask you something?" "Yes," Dr. Sarraj replied royally. The soldier said, "I have a problem, doctor. I live in a settlement near Hebron, and I want to leave." In response, Dr. Sarraj said, "I think it is best if you talked about your feelings with your mother and your father. It will be best if you convince them of your decision. But I want to tell you something else, my friend. By choosing to talk to me about yourself, you made me feel proud of humanity and sure of its futures." The soldier shook the hand of Dr. Sarraj, saying, "I trust you." Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank you for a very, very rich and several semesters worth of material here that you've managed to go through fairly quickly. So I'm sure there are lots of questions. I'll launch with the first question, then I'd ask you if you could just flag to me that you have questions, and we'll open it up for further discussion. I guess my first question, you started out talking about individual variants and differential susceptibility, and you really refrained throughout most of the presentation from breaking that down further into different groups and how chronic conditions of violence might affect specific groups. And I'm thinking, I guess I'm wondering first what the state of the research is in terms of those group differentials. You know, for example, with gender, is there data that's been produced that talks about how these conditions affect girls and boys differently? Or what are the other breakdowns of groups that you see in the literature that you've reviewed? And I'm thinking also, you've done some work on traumatic stress in female Holocaust children, specifically girls and their mothers. I'm wondering if you could tell us, just give us some indicators of the kinds of research that's being done and the kinds of things you're seeing in the literature.
Well, I will not get into all the groups. First of all, there is no, in many of the research, we do not necessarily find, you know, this kind of distinctions between groups. And what I can say in general is that even within, you know, sometimes if you look at, you know, low SES, high SES is one, you know, distinct, you know, group. I think that the major element is the capacity of the parents to, that's one element, to provide, you know, support and safety to the child. It might be when you talk about groups, when you have, you know, a distorted context, ecology in terms of community services, that you might find differences. Talk about gender. I don't know if you would find, you know, differences, but basically what I can tell you on the basis of what we know about gender differences, and that's, you know, some good news, you know, for the females, you know, compared to males, you know, that females are, you know, more, you know, resilient. And I cannot, you know, I will not get into, you know, all kinds of research about it, you know, and it begins from the very beginning. Actually, you know, you may notice that, you know, there is a higher level of birth rate of males compared to females, and you wonder why. And, you know, some of the explanation is that, you know, that, you know, in order to balance it, because nature created women to be more resilient for all kinds of reasons, and I don't have time to get into that. And, you know, it's then, you know, from the beginning, you begin, you know, with unequal, you know, demography to, you know, to make it symmetric as it develops. So basically, in general, females in various contexts are more resilient than males. So it might now. Here it's very problematic, you see, especially in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian context. We should notice, you know, that in this violent context, males are more active in violence. Okay, so they are more exposed, and in females are less exposed. By definition, we have some information showing a relationship between direct exposure and it was on one of my slides, direct exposure and the outcomes. Talking about the Holocaust, it's in my paper. I simply eliminated it from my presentation because I knew that I'm going to run out of time. But because it was raised here, it gives me, you know, really, I'll do it quickly because I know that other people may, you know, have questions. But what I can tell you amazingly, we did extensive research on Holocaust survivors, three generations, first, second, and third generation. And we analyzed all the available research, you know, and what we find amazingly, no transmission to the second and the third generation. And I can stand strongly behind it. I know that it may go against various myths that people, you know, heard about second generation, third generation, but I could provide the evidence that, you know, and we have, you know, articles about it, that it's quite, you know, clear-cut, that there are no transmissions. So again, you know, people have, you know, and we talk about the Holocaust, which was, you know, the atrocities are awful, and we still see first generation who have many, many problems of the kind that I mentioned, anxiety and fear, etc., etc. I am a second generation to the Holocaust, and I know my mother, you know, very highly traumatized. And I know what it means, you know, to deal, you know, with a highly traumatized person. And I'm a psychologist, so I kind of, you know, understand. But hope so. And but amazingly, you know, these people, despite, you know, the trauma, and despite the fact that when you trigger them, you know, around trauma issues and become completely irritated and, you know, disorganized, they manage to provide sufficiently, what we call in our, you know, in our field, good enough parenting, you know, not excellent, good enough. If a child is exposed to good enough parent, you know, mother, father, he will do it, you know, quite well. So that's as far as the Holocaust. Now, we do not find, you know, in some of the studies that we did it with females. We don't have, you know, information about males for different methodological and logistic reasons, but other studies, I don't think that you find, you know, really gender differences to a large extent. Simply, these people manage to set aside the trauma, which is an issue in itself. What does it mean to set aside the trauma, you know, and to function properly as parents, which is very, you know, promising when you think about, you know, genocides. Again, it's in my, you know, it's in my written paper in my monograph. I'm going to say more about it. You know, it has, you know, it has some. We all, you know, in, you know, here in USIP and other places, we talk about reconciliation, especially in, you know, societies that underwent, you know, genocide, and how can it be overcome. But I can tell you, at least on the basis of our work, you know, with the Holocaust, and maybe, you know, maybe the situation. I don't want to take too much time, you know. We talk about a genocide took place, you know, in a different place, and we don't live together, you know, with the people who caused the genocide, and maybe, you know, it helped. But still, you know, when we look at, you know, the relationship between Israel and Germany, I won't say, you know, there is reconciliation, but it's a full-fledged, you know, normal relationships, and sometimes you wonder how it happened. I think that to a large extent, it's the mental capacity that I described throughout my presentation, as well as infrastructure. I think that the fact that Israelis could experience a very high level of infrastructure, as well as realization that, you know, over time you have to accept reality and you have to begin, you know, making exchange, you know, even, you know, with people who cause, you know, so horrible atrocities. And of course, you know, it's the old generation is no longer, you know, in existence. We talk about second and third generation in the Germany country. So, you know, so I think it has implication also, you know, for those who are interested in reconciliation and trust building in other places, you know, that experienced, you know, severe genocides.
All right, I see a few questions.
What exactly do you mean by by infrastructure. Are you talking about physical infrastructure, health, education? What kind of infrastructure?
Exactly. Exactly. I'm talking about, you know, community infrastructure. You know, I take Israel again as an example. You know, we have, you know, health system, welfare system, education. You know, now it's summer, so the school system, you know, so the school is not functioning. And I wonder what would have happened, you know, in the school system. But I could, you know, guess, because we have some experience. And this is very heavy shelling now. It's something, you know, by the Hezbollah in certain areas of Israel. But we have, you know, this tendency to habituate. To the better and to the worse. I mean, you know, the question is, you know, what does it mean that when you habituate, you know, to such, you know, that you get used to it? And in a way, you can habituate because you know that you have functioning institutions. And I could see, and they talk already. I read, you know, emails, and, you know, they closed my university. They closed it, you know, in the past 5 days. Now we see already emails, you know, saying, okay, they're going to open it up. It's, and I believe, you know, it's going to be the case, you know, in other institutions, despite the shellings, you know, because very quickly the society, because of this well-developed infrastructure, can recruit all the sources and to provide the services to people and to make sure, you know, that you could continue, you know, with employment. I mean, it's going to be, you know, very detrimental to the economy, to products, etc., etc. So that, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the very, very basic, you know, infrastructure. And actually, in my recommended acts, I say again, I don't invent any will. It's just, you know, that you find it based on the data. That when we talk about one day, hopefully, some, you know, resolution of the conflict, you know, with the Palestinians. I don't know how and how it's going to happen. It's a great deal of resources. Once you provide the resources, I think it would expedite, you know, the system. I had a discussion with my colleague, Nigel Roberts from the West Bank about economy and the other day, and he was very, you know, modest because he is an economist. So he said, well, it's not only economy, it's, you know, other kinds of things, which I agree. It's a solution. You have to find a solution. You have to find, you know, ceasefire. But I really believe, you know, that the well-being, if you find a way to expedite the physical infrastructure, it helps. It may help to reconciliation, to resolve, you know, the conflict. It's part of the nature of people. You know, when you could, you know, develop wellness and you could concentrate on wellness, it would minimize, you know, and it's part of this transaction model. You know, I could, you know, go back and show, you know, how it works. So, yeah, infrastructure in the very traditional sense. And Israel has been lucky to have it, and I think that it helps to a large extent, even in these very difficult days.
Did you want to follow up on that?
No, just one question. Did Israel make any effort to extend this infrastructure to the territory?
If what is it?
Did the Israeli government make any efforts to extend this infrastructure to the occupied territories?
Well, you know, it varies. It depends, you know. I know that there have been all kinds of attempts with understanding, you know, that you have to deal, you know, with the infrastructure of the other society. But this is a very, you know, complicated issue. I guess, you know, Shimon Peres, who was prime minister of Israel, I think that he had, you know, exactly at the time when he was talking about, you know, the new Middle East, which felt that, you know, he had this notion that you have, you know, to generate resources for the side that suffers more, you know, from toxicity, because it may expedite, you know, the process.
Gentleman back there. Could you please identify yourself? Straight back. The gentleman right there.
Yeah. I'm a couple of notes. I couldn't
sit here. I can't hear. I don't know if I'm
sorry,
microphone.
Can you speak up? Or
yeah,
can you
or maybe come
perhaps
to
come to
microphone.
The table?
You'll hear me.
Or if you could come to the table, then you could have a microphone right there. There's an empty
right
seat here.
Thank you.
It was hard to decide to come today here, because
yeah.
I was hoping to hear a couple of inspiring stories and something to help me cope with the situation, as many people around here know. I'm not surprised, actually. I'm grateful for the model that you presented here and a couple of notes maybe and one question. One note has to do with the feeling throughout the presentation that the Palestinian kids resort to the path to terrorism as a mechanism to cope with the situation. At least one point I picked up, while there is no acknowledgement, I think, that the Israeli kids have a well-designed path to terrorism, terrorism too, but it's not recognized. It's called the IDF or the government or state terrorism, which through it, I think, the legitimate way to express the violence as a post-traumatic disorder, as you articulated that. And I wonder if you consider the IDF and the U.S., the Israeli militarization as a legitimate way of coping with that. The second point, I would really would like to know, how do you think the Israeli right now, and you didn't speak about that at all, and I do appreciate, I come from the same region, Haifa also, and my parents also under the same threat of missiles.
One of the coexisting cities.
Yes, and yeah. How do you think the Israeli public right now deal with the half a million Lebanese displaced, and thousands of Lebanese injured, and hundreds are killed, in this context of the theory that you're presenting. And maybe the final point in here is maybe the point of suggestion is to put a context for this. It's very hard to compare Palestinian condition through occupation, something that you didn't even use the term. I'm left with the notion that this is equal symmetric conflict, where the victims are the same in the two sides, with the same scope, the same intensity, with the same cost being paid. And I know you I would like to know how would you relate to that. So basically those three points, the context and the symmetry, and how would you explain the Lebanese context. And this notion of state terrorism, this I think entry that you chose to explain it through terrorism, is something that needs to be also done in the Israeli society, rather than painting the Israeli ways of dealing with it as legitimate and normal, while the Palestinian, we need to deal with them because they might become terrorists. I think there's a bit of asymmetry there, and I'd appreciate your balanced, flexible, open, ready to explore, reconcilable approach.
Maybe
you want to gather them.
No, maybe I'll try with this because Muhammad raised a number of questions. I don't want to forget. I'll try to relate it together. Well, first of all, I apologize if somehow what I was trying to convey was misunderstood. That that I refer to Palestinian kids. That I emphasize the notion of the Palestinians as becoming more oriented toward terrorism. That's definitely was not my intention. I was just trying to, exactly because of the asymmetry. Because I could see the asymmetry, I'm not surprised. And if we adopt the model of Dr. Mokadam, I just was trying to show it, and I must tell you that, many in many of my presentations in Israeli context, many Israelis don't like, what I say because of this, element of, societal obstacles, because it's, expressing, sympathy, Well, I think, from a pure scientific point of view, that's what you see. You see these directions, and the way to deal, with your second question, it's related, and I don't want to turn it into, a political, debate here, the role of the ADF and the perception of the IDF, but, what I can tell you, just to explain how, again, in psychology, as psychologists who try to understand the difference, Ami Ayalon, that I mentioned, was here, and he mentioned those who participate in this session. He said, that when he met, Yad El-Sarraj in a meeting, at the height of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, he told him, Yad El-Sarraj told Ayalon. And remember, Ayalon was, the head of the Shin Bet, so, he knows, all these guys very well. And he told me, we won. Yad El-Sarraj told him, we won. With the Al-Aqsa, I said, what do you mean we won? And he said, we found the way. You have the IDF. because you have a country, and you know, the country developed the IDF, and you use F-16, you know, to make us suffer. We use what we have, you know, the man, again, you know, perceived options, and you know, we use what we have. We found, you know, the weakness in your society, and once we know that it's, you know, that the weakness is the same, that suffering is very bad, you know, to both sides, maybe it will ignite, you know, some kind of a different process. About the current Israel's approach to the situation, I think it's too early to say, you know. Well, I got some data, let's see, showing that it's a poll that was done, public opinion poll that was done yesterday, not at all caring about what is happening to the Lebanese. On the contrary, I would say that when you look now, at this very time, two-thirds of the people support the policy of the people. Two-thirds. So again, individual differences, you know, it's a lot. Two-thirds, it's a lot. But still, a third does not say support. But I would say that at this time, it's too early to say what will happen. And it will take a long time to anticipate that Israelis will find, that in the end of the day, you know, something will have to be done, you know, with the infrastructure in Lebanon. It's, you know, you touched upon an issue that right now it's not indicative, I think. You know, when you look, you know, at the information right now, it's exactly what, you know, you would expect according to social psychology, you know, theory and data of Daniel Bartal about this, you know, the psychological elements of, you know, of intractable conflict. What you do, you have to, you know, defend yourself psychologically to say that what I'm doing is right to survive. Well, with time, I think it will be transient and you will see breaks in these attitudes with, you know, increasing number of people who will, you know, raise concerns, I hope and believe, you know, about the destructed, you know, infrastructure in Lebanon.
Okay. Why don't we gather up a few questions now? We're coming toward the end, and then we'll give Avi a chance to respond. Got 1, 2, 3, 4.
So you want me to take it all together?
If we could take them, and then I'll let you choose
okay.
What you can answer. I think
you
may not be able to answer.
2 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
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 All right. Do you want to start? Sure.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Isha Pant. My question to you is, how do you like to compare the situation of children who are born into warlike situations and live with it throughout their lives, like those in Israel and Palestine, and to those who see a war start and end in their life, like those in Sierra Leone? And I'm also interested in Sierra Leone. Okay. And I'm also interested in knowing the effects that an intense and short time event like Rwandan genocide have on children.
Do you want to take that first?
I think we'll go ahead. No, I'm not sure that you got the first question.
I think she was talking about the difference between children who grow up all their life with war going on and those who are born.
Where?
Who grow up, for example, Israel-Palestine.
With guns.
They're born into a situation of war versus war comes during their life. Like Sierra Leone, to give
yeah.
an example.
Well,
do you want to go ahead?
Again, you know, I don't have information. What I can tell you, and Jeannie mentioned before about child soldiers, as much as I know about it, I don't know very much. There are very, very, you know, differential, you know, the differences between, you know, we talk about child soldiers because it's a very, you know, difficult, you know, phenomenon, but, you know, different motivations. And I would say that when children are born into an intractable conflict, okay, grown into intractable conflict, and they live in... Again, and go back to the same thing, you know, in a system which provides good infrastructure, I think that the prospect is quite good. I can say, you know, I'm part of, you know, of of an intractable conflict. I was born, you know, exactly the time that the State of Israel was established. I remember myself, you know, all this in all time. And sit here in Washington, you know, successfully, you know, could, you know, give a lecture here, you know, about, you know, work on wars, because the infrastructure and the family, you know, could provide the support. I think that when you have, you know, short term, and you know, in a war, if that was the question, I'm not sure that I understood completely clearly. You know, if you just get into it as you grow, again, the shortest, the better. The shortest, the better. We know from different places that when you have short exposure, even to very acute traumas and dangers, it will disappear. Again, with the assumption that you could provide sufficient support to parents and families in the community to function as, you know, as families and communities. As for Rwanda, again, could you, I'm not sure that I...
I think that was just an example of the short term.
Of the short term, yeah. Well, I don't want to simplify. You know, Rwanda is a different, you know, is a different issue. You talk about, you know, genocide. We've seen this, you know, within the same country, people have to live, you know, with each other. So it's not that the trauma has ended. I mean, trauma has, you know, very broad definitions, you know. You have, you know, the direct, you know, the genocide and what happened, but then, you know, you have to go, you know, beyond it. And I don't think that I, you know, could refer to that really, you know, in depth. But I think that, in general, the capacity is there to overcome, not to reach closure. I don't think that, you know, one could use the term, you know, reaching closure, but, you know, to build up, you know, a mental health, you know, structure with a great deal of intervention there. Because somehow, you know, when you compare Rwanda, you know, to Israel, somehow Israel from the very beginning was building up, you know, infrastructures, which I'm not sure is the case in Rwanda. To the same extent, which certainly plays, you know, as an impeding factor, you know, when you, but it's much more complicated than that.
I think we have time for one question, and the gentleman there, if you still have, did you have a question? Yeah. We'll let you go, and then perhaps just, those who have remaining questions could stay after and continue the conversation with Avi.
Yeah, okay, this is a question about peacemaking progress.
I'm sorry, could you identify yourself?
Sorry, Nigel Roberts from the World Bank. This is a question about the peacemaking process itself. My own observation of how negotiations are conducted from the beginning of the Oslo process through until the last several months was that they tended to resemble themselves a form of conflict rather than a genuine attempt to resolve conflict. And it seemed to me that part of the reason for that was that the various parties came to the table more eager to assert their rights and to try and instill their perspective on what they felt the correct solutions were than to listen to the case, the perspective, the realities of the people across the other side of the table. Now, I wonder if we don't need something of a different approach to this whole process, which is in fact based on some kind of shared experience of trauma and some kind of process of being able to admit participation in all of the corrosive experiences that constitute the last bombs. In other words, more of a reconciliation process rather than a formal chess-like, combative, conventional negotiating structure.
I guess, Nigel, I understand quite well what you are talking about, and you know, I don't have experience, you know, with these kinds of negotiations, because that's maybe part of the problem, you know, that, you know, some people at the political level feel that they have, you know, they were elected to do it, you know, but they feel that they have, you know, the capacity to do it, you know, quite well, and not always do they choose the right, you know, disciplines, maybe. And actually, you are talking here psychology. I totally agree. From your own observation in the area as an economist, so I agree. And there are some attempts at a lower level. There are many, many people-to-people, you know, projects which failed, as we know, and this is a different, you know, topic, and they failed, as you may well know, just because of the lack of capacity to appraise well and to appraise sincerely the feelings of the other side. So there are all kinds of attempts, like writing. You're talking about there are some attempts to do some joint writing of the history, which is very important. It might, you know, bridge the gap. But you're talking rightly, I think, about the needs to enhance interactions where you talk about the shared trauma. Like, you know, and some people do it. It's not enough. It's a low level. There is a forum called the Parents Forum. You send me, you know, the wonderful, you know, interview with one of the mothers. And I think that maybe that's what you would like to see more, you know. It's a forum, a parents forum of parents, bereaved parents who lost their kids in this bloody struggle, you know. Parents of children who got killed, you know, in suicide bombing, and Palestinians whose, you know, children got killed, you know, in Israeli attacks, raids, and things like that. And they talk. That's exactly what, like, you know, they talk about, you know, they shared, you know, experiences, and unique experiences, unique as well as shared experiences. And the point is not only to talk about the shared experience, but the unique. See, to what extent, you know, I can understand that you might have, you know, some unique experiences that might not necessarily, you know, are within, you know, the context of my experience. This is a very difficult, you know, topic, and again, it has to do with people to people. It has to do one day, hopefully, when we will deal, you know, with hopefully, you know, reconciliation under, you know, situation of, you know, peace arrangements. I couldn't agree more with it, you know, that it's lacking, probably. I'm not there in all this, you know, I was not there in all these negotiations and, you know, dialogues, but I could see easily the gaps, you know, and lack of role-taking, lack of understanding, you know, of the other side, and also the cultural context. One has to, I wonder, you know, in how many of these negotiations people use anthropologists as experts, you know, anthropologists who might, you know, shed light, you know, on the different, you know, cultural backgrounds. And then we make, you know, a misinterpretation about reactions because we reflect, you know, our expectation, which may not go hand in hand with what you could expect in a different culture. And then we end up, you know, with negative interpretation and stereotypes.
Thank you very much. On that note, I think we'll close. I'd like to thank Dr. Avisagi Schwartz for an illuminating presentation. There are copies of his paper outside for those of you who are interested in getting them. This is a work in progress. It's getting to the close of the period that he's progressing on it, and I'm sure he'd welcome timely feedback from any of you who might have feedback that you haven't had a chance to give him, either now or by email. The email address is listed on the paper. Also, I'd like to invite you to the last of our Senior Fellow Project Reports, which will take place on Monday, same room, from 12:30 to 2, and it's by Albakir Mukhtar, who will be talking about On the Margins of Northern Identity, looking at the conflict in Darfur. So I invite you to that, and I thank you all for your patience and for staying and coming in this weather, and look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.